This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Jim Bertel. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi says in his monthly radio address Sunday that COVID has shaken India. Nearly 350,000 new COVID cases have been recorded in the previous 24-hour period, yet another daily record. The new infection figures are likely undercounted, public health officials have warned. The U.S. is under pressure from the international community to release some of its warehoused COVID vaccines to India and other countries that need the shots. In addition to hundreds of thousands of new daily COVID cases, India is also experiencing an oxygen shortage. In Iraq, the Iraqi Interior Ministry says at least 82 people died and 110 were wounded in a Baghdad COVID-19 hospital fire overnight. Reuters' Jason Albano reports.
They said the fire occurred after an accident caused an oxygen tank to explode. Dozens of others were also injured in the fire. Patients not injured during the incident were being transferred out of the hospital. One official said the fire has since been put out. Video and social media showed citizens joining firefighters as they searched a smoke-filled ward for more survivors. Iraq's healthcare system has been stretched thin during the global health crisis. That's on top of decades of sanctions, war, and neglect. The health ministry says more than 1 million people have been infected and more than 15,000 dead so far.
That is Reuters' Jason Albano reporting. Southeast Asian leaders are demanding an immediate end to killings and the release of political detainees in Myanmar. The leaders of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations also told Senior General Min Aung Hlaing during the two-hour talks in Jakarta that a dialogue between contending parties in Myanmar should immediately start. This is VOA News. Indonesia's Navy says its missing submarine has sunk and cracked open after finding items from the vessel over the past 2 days, apparently ending the hope of finding any of the 53 crew members alive. The military crew says the presence of an oil slick as well as debris near the site where the submarine last dove Wednesday off the island of Bali were clear proof that KRI Nagala 402 had sunk. U.S. President Joe Biden says the 1915 massacre of Armenians in the Ottoman Empire constituted genocide, a historic declaration that infuriated Turkey and is set to further strain already frayed ties between the two NATO allies. Reuters' Fred Katayama has more.
U.S. President Joe Biden on Saturday made a historic declaration that infuriated Turkey. He said the 1915 massacres of Armenians in the Ottoman Empire constituted genocide. In a statement, Biden said the American people honor, in his words, all those Armenians who perished in the genocide that began 106 years ago today, adding, we affirm the history. We do this not to cast blame, but to ensure that what happened is never repeated. The largely symbolic move breaks away from decades of carefully calibrated language from the White House. Turkey's foreign ministry said it opens a deep wound between the two countries. Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu tweeted, we entirely reject this statement based solely on populism. Biden's decision comes at a time of strained ties. Washington and Ankara have had deep policy differences over a host of issues.
That is Reuters' Fred Katayama reporting. 15 people who spent 40 days in voluntary isolation in a dark, damp cave in France have emerged from a scientific experiment. AP's Zaria Shackley has more.
The group, made of 8 men and 7 women, took part in the experiment in the Pyrenees. Speaking to reporters outside the cave after they emerged, the group said they barely noticed any fatigue after being in isolation, but they felt the cold. Scientists at the Human Adaptation Institute, leading the $1.5 million Deep Time project, say the experiment will help them better understand how people adapt to drastic changes in living conditions and environments. I'm Zaria Shackley.
For more on any of today's top news, please visit us at voanews.com or use the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Clote has the day off.
WFP and other agencies are working tirelessly to prevent the scourge of famine, and the only way is through sustained assistance to people who are on the brink of such catastrophe. We're extremely worried about people inaccessible in some parts of northeast Nigeria due to conflict.
UN agencies warn of worsening food insecurity in northeastern Nigeria.
They will see a Zambia where we're combating corruption through integrity committees and public institutions. They would see investment in tax credits as opposed to tax holidays, and they would see the creation of more economic zones in different parts of the country where they do not exist.
Zambia's governing Patriotic Front, PF, launches its manifesto ahead of the upcoming August 12th general election.
The checks and balance system is non-existent in our country. The judiciary and parliament are totally dysfunctional and are not able to provide the necessary checks and balances to the executive. The broader implication is that the so-called Second Republic is worse than the first one.
And Zimbabwe's parliament passed a bill to amend the constitution, with the critics complaining it would give the president wide powers to circumvent public scrutiny in appointing judges. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. UN agencies are warning that worsening food insecurity in northeastern Nigeria could lead to famine amid cutbacks in operations by some aid organizations due to insecurity in the region. Reporter Monaki Chooks from Abuja, Nigeria, spoke with WFP and FAO on the situation.
A new Hunger Health Sports report by the World Food Programme and the Food and Agriculture Organization says northern Nigeria is one of the world's worst affected areas. Chi Layel, spokesperson for WFP in Nigeria, says about 6.8 million Nigerians will not know where their next meal will come from at the height of the hunger season between June and August, as conflict engulfs Nigeria's northern states.
Most of the people in need are in the country's northeastern states of Borno, Adamawa and Yobe, where 12 years of conflict have displaced millions of people and disrupted livelihoods. Our concern is that without immediate and sustained food assistance, 800,000 people will face emergency levels of hunger. That's just one step away from famine.
The World Food Programme says famine has not been declared in any part of Nigeria, but alarming conflict is fueling hunger.
WFP and other agencies are working tirelessly to prevent the scourge of famine, and the only way is through sustained assistance to people who are on the brink of such catastrophe. We're extremely worried about people inaccessible in some parts of northeast Nigeria due to conflict.
UN Humanitarian Coordinator Edward Callan, in a statement, said the UN has temporarily suspended operations in northeast Nigeria due to attacks in the surrounding areas, with hopes of resuming operations as soon as possible. With more than a decade of the conflict, the humanitarian crisis in northeastern Nigeria remains one of the most serious in the world. In 2019, the security situation worsened and risks for humanitarian workers increased. Al-Hassan Sise, head of FAO's Northeast Nigeria program, lamented the instability caused by the crisis.
Indeed, the decade-long armed conflict and COVID-19 impact have continued to affect the humanitarian situation in Northeast Nigeria. This also has resulted into increase in food and agriculture input prices that exacerbated the food insecurity by making access to food more difficult for conflict-affected population.
The UN and its partners condemned attacks on and abduction of aid workers and urged all parties in the conflict to facilitate humanitarian operations. For VOA News, this is Munachi Chooks from Abuja.
Zambia's governing Patriotic Front, PF, has launched its manifesto ahead of the upcoming August 12th general election. The party says the manifesto includes detailed plans seeking to improve living standards, as well as an ambitious economic recovery agenda to mitigate the impact of the global coronavirus pandemic. But critics say President Edgar Lungu and his administration have failed to meet the aspirations of the people. They cite what they say has been excessive borrowing and the failure to pay the country's bills to international debtors, as well as promises to combat endemic corruption. Zambians go to the polls in August to choose a new president and parliament. Sande Chanda is the media director for the governing PF. He tells VOA's Peter Klote that the party's people-centered manifesto seeks to create jobs for the youth, financially empower women, and improve the country's infrastructure.
The manifesto launched yesterday by His Excellency President Edgar Lungu firstly runs on the theme that I would want to make every Zambian count, or making every Zambian count, continuity for a prosperous, peaceful, stable, and an all-inclusive Zambia. And this manifesto, again, builds on the economic recovery program launched by His Excellency last year, the 2020 to 2023. Mindful again that we are in an environment where the economy, has not performed so well, of course, largely owing to the COVID pandemic and many other factors that could have come in as a result of the pandemic. So the economic recovery program 2020 to 2023, which the president launched last year, remember, had set out its own targets, such as, attaining real GDP growth rate of about 3% by the year 2022, reducing the pace of debt accumulation and genuine sustainability in the next 3 to 5 years.
With this manifesto that has been launched, what is in it for the ordinary Zambian?
What this manifesto seeks to do, Peter, is to put the Zambian people right at the center of our development agenda. You are going to see more of a manifesto that says, let's have a lot of opportunities going for every Zambian, especially the youth, the women, and persons with disabilities. So government, again, now is committing itself over and beyond and more than we've done in the last 10 years and more than what we've done in the last 5 years. Anybody from outside Zambia, for example, wants to come and do business in Zambia, if there's any project that has to be done, that has to be done with the full involvement of the Zambians. So we're bringing the Zambian people right at the center of our development agenda.
Critics of the government, including the UPND, have said that there has been an overborrowing by this present government and that the borrowing has been excessive, which has crippled the Zambian economy before the COVID-19 even hit, they argue. And they said Zambians should not trust the manifesto which has been written because it's just a publicity stunt to score cheap political points and win votes in the upcoming elections. How do you respond to such criticism?
Well, Peter, there's nothing new that is coming from our colleagues in the UPND in terms of their criticisms. We have borrowed, and it's a statement of fact, and we borrowed for development. We have not borrowed for consumption. So, if the UPND is saying that we didn't build infrastructure, then we can agree with them. If they are saying that we haven't transformed the country, we can agree with them. We have reduced the power deficit, for example, and the UPND is saying, no, it's not the PF that has reduced the power deficit, it's because we've had sufficient rains. Again, these are the sort of arguments that you're getting from the UPND.
Moving forward, what should the people of Zambia expect from President Edgar Chagwa Lungu if they decide in August to repose confidence in him to re-elect? What is he going to do that will be different to transform their lives if they were to give him a second-term mandate?
Peter, some of the things that the people of Zambia could look forward to over the next 5 years under President Edgar Lungu would be that they would see a transformed agriculture sector, able to contribute and to double, contribution of the agricultural sector to the country's GDP. They would see, the promotion of more Zambian-owned enterprises, a robust citizen-led industrialization drive aimed, of course, at import substitution and wealth creation. They would see the creation of a stabilization fund to cushion the economy against unfavorable fluctuations in metal prices. They would see a diversified foreign exchange reserves where we are prioritizing gold as a reserve asset. They would see the promotion of entrepreneurship by making affordable loans available to Zambians. And they would see a Zambia where we strengthen the prudent use of resources. They would see a Zambia where we're combating corruption through integrity committees and public institutions. They would see investment in tax credits as opposed to tax holidays, and they will see the creation of more economic zones in different parts of the country where they do not exist.
Sande Chanda, the media director for the governing Zambia PF, he spoke with my colleague Peter Klote. Zimbabwe's parliament, controlled by the ruling party, has passed a bill to amend the constitution. Critics complain it will give the president wide powers to circumvent public scrutiny in appointing judges and cripple the checks and balances that prevent authoritarian rule. Ade Gondo has more on the story.
Bill was passed with a majority of 191 legislators saying aye to 22 parliamentarians who objected to the legislation. Critics say the recent vote gives a semblance of bipartisan consent due to a judiciary-assisted purge from Parliament of opposition legislators from the Movement for Democratic Change, MDC Alliance, and their replacement with colluding legislators from the Douglas Monzora-led MDCT group. They say that the reality is that the opposition ranks of the MDC Alliance have been hollowed out through a series of court judgments in the ruling party's bid to install a pliable opposition in its drive to establish a de facto one-party state. The Constitutional Amendment No. 2 passed on Tuesday and is set for final reading in the Senate before being signed. It stipulates, among other issues, that the President will nominate candidates from those who are already sitting as judges in the High Court and Supreme Court and appoint them to the Constitutional Court. Though there is a provision to consult the Judicial Service Commission, the President is not bound to follow its advice. Legal experts say the bill, when enacted into law, means the president will single-handedly decide whether or not a judge of the High Court or Supreme Court can be elevated to a higher court. Human rights lawyer Doug Coulter weighs in, describing the amendment as a set day and an effort to consolidate power into the hands of the president.
It undermines the independence of the judiciary in that now the president will have vast powers to be able to appoint judges without going through the interview process and the recommendation process that comes from the JSC, which was meant to protect the independence of the judiciary. That has effectively been scrapped. It undermines the prosecutor general independence in that now the prosecutor general will also be selected by the president at whim.
Quartet adds that one of the possible implications of the amendment is the effect it will have on other institutions which have played a role in preserving human rights in the country, like the Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission, ZHRC.
Which has been one of the more effective of our independent commissions and has actually held the government to account. This essentially guts the Human Rights Commission of some of its core functions, which will be handed to a prosecutor general who will essentially be handpicked by the president as well. And so the purpose of these amendments is clearly just to consolidate power in the president, to remove all fetters or checks and balances against his power so that he can rule essentially as a dictator.
Presidential spokesman George Charamba responded to critics on his Twitter handle. He wrote that the amendment cures what the 2013 constitution did to oust a tried and tested practice that preserved the dignity of the office of judges by sparing them from public scrutiny. Political analysts reject the assertion. Thomas Stolle is among those who see an inadvertent spiral into dictatorship, calling the much-touted new reform by Mnangagwa's government a mere ruse.
The political implication of this is that the checks and balance system is non-existent in our country. The judiciary and parliament are totally dysfunctional and are not able to provide the necessary checks and balances to the executive. The broader implication is that the so-called Second Republic is worse than the first one.
According to observers and political analysts such as Tole, democratic space in the country is rapidly shrinking due to what they say is the ruling party's concerted and cunning efforts to silence dissenting voices in the country. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
In Lesotho, Cabinet Minister Professor Nkosi Mahau has announced plans to resign from the governing All Basotho Congress, ABC, to form another party. Mahau, who is the deputy leader of the ABC, says a significant number of parliamentarians will be joining him to form the yet-to-be-named rival party. Answering media questions about his plans, Professor Mahau says about 47 lawmakers from the ABC in the 120-member parliament will be joining him to form the new party. It is, however, unclear when he plans to form the opposition party. Analysts say the split in the ABC could threaten the stability of the government because the party with the majority in parliament chooses the prime minister. Meanwhile, local media reports say Prime Minister Majoro appears to have lost support from some members of the ABC party in parliament. For analysis on the latest developments, VOA's Peter Klote reached Talhanga Lisi, political science lecturer at the National University of Lesotho.
The leaving of Professor Mahau to form a new party is likely to have an impact on the current ruling coalition, which is between the All Basotho Convention and the Democratic Congress, DC, in the sense that if the ABC, as the leading partner, loses such a significant number, obviously that is going to bring some change of balance of seats within the coalition government. It might come to a position where, if numbers keep on increasing, because at the moment we don't know the exact number of MPs who are defecting, it might come to a situation where the DC is likely to be in the majority. And if that happens, we are likely to see the change of premiership, in the sense that the DC will definitely want to take the lead.
Do you think Professor Mahau has a legitimate reason for his decision to form a breakaway political party, a new one, to basically rival or challenge the ABC for political dominance in the Kingdom of Lesotho?
This was the only alternative that Professor Mahau was left with. Since he officially joined the party about 2 years back, the party has been embroiled in a lot of battles, internal instability. That saw him and other members of the party not concentrating on anything meaningful, but trying to find solutions. And this seemed to be an endless war. So for a person like him who would want to preserve his integrity, I think there was no other alternative but to leave and try to find a political home that would be more stable than the ABC. Apart from that, you will recall that since he came into the ABC, he was never really accepted, particularly by the leader. In the last 2 weeks, there were some new plans where the earlier rival groups within the party had now come together and were planning his ouster. So he had to be proactive, otherwise he was going to be fired.
Why do you think the Prime Minister has suddenly become unpopular with some of his supporters within the ruling ABC? I'm talking about the parliamentarians in the ABC. He just took over not long ago.
I think there are at least two explanations to this. First of all, we will recall that Dr. Majoro has really never been a political powerhouse in himself. You will recall that he only came to office as a compromise prime minister because there was no one who could come in. They had to find somebody who was a sort of a compromise between the factions within the ABC itself. So the fact that he was never really a powerhouse was already going to work against him. This is why it was so easy for him to fall whenever he made small mistakes. The second explanation would be that really, Dr. Majoro has never really been a politician. He is more of a technocrat than a politician. So since he came to office, he was really not in a position to lead the way he was expected to lead. He was somehow not able to make decisions when it mattered most. So he was became very unpopular. And maybe the last explanation would be his perceived arrogance, being an educated man who comes from high places such as World Bank. Some people see him to be arrogant. He seems to be a little bit aloof. So this is how he lost his popularity with ordinary MPs. And maybe, lastly, by going back to former Prime Minister Thabane, who in the past has shown so much dislike for Dr. Majoro himself, this has shown, it has proved him to be somehow of a leader who does not have much of a backbone. This is why some of the MPs are calling for his ouster.
Tolhanga Lesi, a political science lecturer at the National University of Lesotho, speaking with my colleague Peter Klote. South Africa has launched a plan for the tourism sector to recover after a full year of COVID-19-induced disruptions. The plan, the result of extensive consultation and collaboration with stakeholders, seeks to revive both domestic and international tourism, with the government and the private sector working together. Tourism employed 1.5 million people and contributed over $27 billion to the economy, but has been barely surviving since the pandemic began. Thuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
As she introduced the plan recently, Tourism Minister Mamloko Kubai Ngubane urged stakeholders to ensure that all hands are on the deck to restore the country's tourism sector. She noted that revenue in the food and beverages sector in 2020 slumped 40% compared with 2019. Total income from tourist accommodations went down by almost 73% in February 2021 when compared to February 2020, which was a month before COVID-19 struck. Kubai Ngubane said the recovery plan has specific targeted outcomes.
It's greater diversification of the supply side of the tourism market, increased quantum and focus of infrastructure investment in the tourism sector, protection and creation of jobs in the sector, a recovered sector, greater confidence in South Africa as a safe destination, increased international arrivals.
The plan also encourages industry players to explore new ways of doing things in the new normal as the world adapts to the presence of COVID-19. These include offering travelers refund guarantees, getting flexible with booked dates, and using contactless technology for most services. The government is expected to play a big role in ensuring the implementation of protocols meant to help protect tourists from contracting COVID-19. And Dyke Coates, acting mayor for Mossel Bay in the Western Cape province, says speed vaccination should be a key priority.
We've lost the Easter section and then also obviously over the December holidays. So at this stage businesses are on their knees. We cannot afford it, and that's why it's very important that we get the vaccines to get that roll out.
All government departments have been brought on board to ensure that there is timely visa processing, enough protection for tourists, and speed vaccination program to quickly reach herd immunity. The Tourism Business Council of South Africa estimates the sector lost close to $5 billion in the first 100 days of the COVID-19 lockdown that started in March last year. By the end of 2020, many restaurants, especially smaller outlets, had shut their doors for good. many of those still open are struggling to restore full operations. Chifiwa Chivengwa is the head of the council.
Tourism has always been resilient. We have survived many, many different things, including 9/11 in the U.S., which changed the way we travel today. We've always bounced back. One of the things that people do after this type of situation is to travel. And South Africa should be, you know, on top of mind when they decide where to travel.
The plan also targets embassies, neighboring countries, and specific overseas markets to attract as many people as possible to visit South Africa. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, sports and the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent. But first, in an exclusive interview with VOA, Adrian Hill, the director of Oxford University's Jenner Institute, says their new malaria vaccine has shown a preliminary efficacy rate of 77% in testing in Burkina Faso. That could help prevent over 400,000 deaths a year, most of them in sub-Saharan Africa. Henry Wilkins looks at the burden of malaria on families in the region and the potential impact of the new vaccine in this report from Kaya, Burkina Faso.
Pelissa Wadogo fled to Gadji village 2 years ago when insurgents attacked, killing her neighbours and brother-in-law. The 32-year-old thought she had escaped sudden death. But last week, one of her just months-old twin daughters, Marie, was diagnosed with malaria. She got some more medicine, says Sawadogo, and they were told to go back home. She says that was the last prescription she got before her daughter passed away at home on Sunday. It affected me a lot, says Sawadogo. I can't sleep at night, she says. I can't eat. More than 400,000 people die every year from the mosquito-borne disease, most within sub-Saharan Africa, and mostly children under 5 years old. But there is hope. In an exclusive interview with VOA, the director of Oxford University's Jenner Institute says their new malaria vaccine, tested in Burkina Faso, is showing game-changing results.
So what's so exciting about this result is that 140 malaria vaccine candidates have been tried in clinical trials over the years, and none of them has come up with an efficacy over 75%. That's what the WHO, the World Health Organization, is looking for to be really useful in controlling malaria in Africa. In our first attempt with this vaccine, we see 77%, and we think we can improve on that further. So it's real progress. It's unprecedented.
Adrian Hill says the cost of the new vaccine is expected to be very low and believes widespread use would prevent hundreds of thousands of deaths in Africa each year. While testing is not yet complete, the initial results are also raising hopes with medical aid groups like Doctors Without Borders, MSF. The coordinator of MSF's malaria working group, Dr. Martin de Smet, spoke from Brussels.
If the modalities, the characteristics would make it well feasible to roll out in Africa, that could indeed be a game changer.
The malaria vaccine is entering the final phase of trials in Burkina Faso, Kenya, Mali and Tanzania, and could be widely available in as little as 2 years. But Hill says the Jenner Institute, which developed the AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine, is talking to regulators to see if this vaccine can also be fast-tracked for quicker use.
We're making the point that more people died of malaria in Africa last year by a factor of maybe four than died of COVID. So why isn't malaria a priority?
The malaria vaccine will come too late to save the millions who have died over the years, including Sawadogo's daughter Marie. But perhaps by the time her twin Pauline is old enough to understand what happened to her sister, malaria deaths could be a rarity in Africa instead of a day-to-day reality. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kaya, Burkina Faso.
And now in Nightline Africa Sports, world 800 meters medalist Ferguson Rotich is among the 31 athletes named on the Kenyan team for the World Athletics Relays, Celestia 21, on May 1st and May 2nd. Squads have been announced for the men's and women's 4x200 meters and 4x400 meters, mixed 4x400 meters, 2x2x400 meters, and shuttle hurdles relay. Joining Rotich in the mixed 2x2 400 meters are Commonwealth 800 meters champion Wycliffe Kinyamal, Naomi Korir, and Emily Cherotich. The Kenyan team for the event also features national 400 meters record holder Helen Sombuya and Aaron Koech, who formed part of the mixed 4x400 meters bronze medal winning team at the last edition of the event in Yokohama in 2019. In football, Thursday marked the official arrival of President Patrice Motsepe at the Confederation of African Football headquarters. Accompanied by CAF General Secretary Keron Mosengo Omba and FIFA Council Member Hani Abu Rida, Motsepe met CAF top management president in Cairo. He reportedly expressed his optimism about his mission success, convinced that the current team will make Africa proud. And it's March Day 6 in the Confederation of African Football Confederation Cup group stage, the last before the quarterfinalists are known. The matches to be played on April 28th are as follows. Enyimba of Nigeria host Orlando Pirates of South Africa in Aba. ES Setif of Algeria host Ahele Benghazi of Libya in Setif. In Group B, Bekane of Morocco host Coton Sport of Cameroon. Kabayel of Algeria play Napsa Stars of Zambia. In Group C, Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia play Salitas of Burkina Faso, while CS Sfaxien host Jaraf of Senegal. In Group D, Raja of Morocco hosting Khan of Zambia, and Pyramids of Egypt play Namungo of Tanzania in Cairo. Elsewhere, Cricket South Africa has been stripped of its right to administer the sport in the country by Sports Minister Nathi Mfetwa. This move puts the participation of both the men's and women's teams in international matches at risk. Cricket South Africa has been involved in a number of ongoing wrangles about its leadership and structure for many months, resisting efforts to install more independent directors seen as critical to fighting corruption. Should Cricket South Africa be de-recognized, it could mean that South Africa's cricketers would not be allowed to play in international matches. Like most sporting governing bodies, the International Cricket Body has strict rules that prohibit government intervention in the running of national sports associations. South Africa's men's team are scheduled to play next Ireland in July, while the women's team do not have any firm fixtures until March 2022 at the Women's World Cup. And that's it for this edition of Netline Africa Sports. It's Sunday here on Netline Africa, and it's a time we get to relax and reflect with music from across the continent.
Designer, me love my life. cannot deal. So me say, do you anything, anything, anything for the bed, first thing, any money, medicine. You want me everything, everything, everything. No, me woman to me, you mean everything.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. tia chini, kama ta chini, kama tia chini, kama ta chini, kama tia chini. I'm gonna call you Lola, I'm going to be your kaka. Nagari alifai kuna toyo, na tukichoka da tuende moro. Usinipe gonjwa la moyo, cause you them girls are loyal. You die, you die, you feel. You know you're rocking with the best man. And I've been so lonely in my life, but now I can hold on tonight.
I'm gonna call you Coco, I'm gonna be your Lolo. Wanifanya niwe kama popo. So many times that I want you, baby, baby, oh. Bring me some new love, get me to the door. So many times that I want you. I've been so lonely in my life, but now I can hold on tonight. Cause I decide, 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 decide. Cause I decide, 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 decide.
Come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini. Don't you say that I would deny. Get you down to my soldier. To me, I wanna see you whine. Let us get to that corner.
Don't you see I would not deny. Let me hold your shoulder. I'm gonna really whine and take it slow. Cause I'm falling in love.
Come on, chini. Come on, chini. Come on, chini.
Cause I'm falling in love.
Onenza yona, mbadi fuge.
And that was our Sunday Music Sport on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Please join us again on Saturday. Have a very good evening.